Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Before I get into what I'm going to talk about today, just want a brief explanation about the festival ceremony. There's been throughout history many examples of people being killed because they were Buddhists, and when the Muslims invaded India, I don't remember what century this was, but probably around between the 8th and the 9th century. They came across Nalanda University, which was this huge thing. There were maybe 10,000 monks there, and they thought it was some sort of fort, and so they killed everybody that was there. And we have examples in the last century with the Russian communist takeover. They unearthed 32,000 dead bodies of Buddhists who were killed in eastern Russia or Siberia about 50 years after the fact. And then we had about between 50 and 70,000 Buddhist monks killed in Cambodia in the 1970s. And today we have still going on in both Tibet and Burma, people being killed just because of their practice. So we're honoring them today, and we're offering merit and learning to be grateful for the fact that we have a country in which religious freedom is practiced. So, okay. I'm going to talk today about endarkenment instead of enlightenment. How many people think you're going to get enlightened sometime in the future? Show of hands. How many have had that thought? You're going to get enlightened. So come on. Fess up honestly. Well, enlightenment is something you already have. It's just that you don't see it that way. The Buddha described his enlightenment as simply to see things as they truly are. And it's we look at the world through this filter of self, it's like having really thick, dark glasses on all the time, and all we see is this darkness. And we see all of our likes and dislikes, and we see suffering, and we see the things we don't like about stuff, and the things we don't have, and the things people do that bother us. And this is all part of this very thick endarkenment that we live in. And what we're learning how to do is, instead of practicing endarkenment, we have to see that we can practice something else. We can let go of that, the darkness of our delusions. We need a self to grow up behind as children, but then we have to be able to let go of that as we become spiritual adults. And the self is an illusion. We think that there's a me that goes throughout my life, and I was born at a certain time, and I grew up and went to schools in various places and did this and that job and whatever, and we think that there's a me that is traveling through this time span, but there's nothing in this physical world that is that has a substantial, unchanging reality, and especially not ourselves. Hopefully we are changing. If we're not making some changes in ourselves, we're going to be heavily stuck. And what we have to do is to see when it is that we are filtering things through this self. When we're thinking in terms of these are my thoughts, my feelings, my emotions. Because we identify with and cling to these things that go on in our mind, we create suffering. And I remember asking a high school class once what suffering was, and the young lady, who couldn't have been more than about 14 or 15, said with great poignancy in her voice, she says, "Wanting things to be other than they are." And we have a culture that says you never have enough. You always have to have a newer car, better clothes, a newer, bigger house. You have to have more than whatever you have, it's not enough. And we have a culture that says, simply because you're born, there's something wrong with you. This is the whole culture of original sin. Whether it's said in that way or not, it's something that we have bought into. Somebody who's born in a Buddhist culture is taught to believe that there's something right with you simply because you were born as a human being, because it's the best possible place to be born in. And somebody tried to explain to the Dalai Lama the Western koan of inadequacy, and he just didn't get it. He was born in a Buddhist culture. There's something good about it, the fact that you're born as a human being. And even better that you're born in a situation where you can learn to practice Buddhism. But we're culturally conditioned to think in terms of inadequacy and pride and lack, because this commercial culture feeds on the fact that we don't have enough. We don't have the newest thing or the latest thing or the biggest thing or whatever, and we have to have something other than what we have. And so our economy is based upon shopping, buying this, buying that. And we have to see how the self is conditioned by the culture, how it's conditioned by our education. Our master said one of the hardest things to do is to forgive ourselves for having bought the delusions that our parents and teachers have sold to us. And we're looking through this dark filter of self, this karmically generated reactions. This is a symptom of enlightenment. We react out of fear, we react out of anger, we react out of greed because we're conditioned to do that. And what you're learning in Buddhism is how to be responsible. Our Master Ji used to say, this is a religion for those who want to be spiritual adults. Whatever your age, you can be a spiritual adult when you accept responsibility for whatever's gone on in your life in the past. And whatever you're experiencing right here in the present moment. But we have to look at ourselves. We have to be brutally honest with ourselves and admit what it is that's going on. If you could have a mean, nasty, and petty thought and say, that was a mean, nasty, petty thought, and let it go, you're okay. If you have this mean, nasty, petty thought and you feel you have to act on it, you're in trouble. If you have this mean, nasty, and petty thought and you think you're a bad person because you just had this mean, nasty, petty thought, you're also in trouble. Because you've got to let go of the judgments in order to see things as they are. Many of you have heard this story because I've told it 100 times about this old horse who one day when I was trying to get on as a little kid, he stepped on the toe of my boot and I couldn't get on or off, and I didn't have the foresight to think that I could just take my boot off, so I got angry at this horse. And I picked up a little stick and I started to hit him. And it was some sort of trigger for him. He'd been taught all sorts of things. And it was so with great dignity, he picked up his knee and put his one knee down and then the other knee down. And he put his head all the way down and he bowed. And I was just blown away. I just thought, oh, I've been a bad person here. I hit this horse. And for 25 years, I didn't want to go near that. I didn't remember that it had happened. And my mother, who had been very instrumental in teaching respect for animals, I mean, you could fight with your brother and sister, but you couldn't hurt the dog or the cat. So. But after she died, I had just gotten the word about going to England for a year, and this was in 76. So we did the funeral here, and I was doing these memorials, and in the midst of this memorial, one of these memorials, this memory popped up, and I thought, ooh, what a fantastic teaching, you know, that here this horse is bowing to this little angry little kid. But I couldn't see this while I had this judgment that said, bad person. That was the end of it. I couldn't learn anymore because I'd already concluded that I was a bad person, and so there wasn't anything else to learn. You know, that was it. That's what judgment's about. Because once you come to the conclusion there, then there isn't any place to move. There's nothing to learn, there's nothing to see. So you're just stuck with bad person for the rest of your life. Until you start taking a look at those things and realize that you can actually see them and learn from them. And that's like lifting this veil of endarkenment so that you don't have to see everything through that dark screen of judgment, that bad person. And looking at our hurt feelings, our master used to say, where there's hurt, there's self. And when somebody does things that hurt our feelings, we have to take a good look at that, because most of the time, they're doing exactly the same thing that we're doing, only we haven't recognized that we're doing it. And our little hurt feelings are there because there's something we haven't looked at. And we need to take the Band-Aid off of that wound and let some air and light in there and let it heal, because that hurt is clinging to some fear or inadequacy or some idea of self that we haven't been able to let go of. And this is also a symptom of endarkenment, that's clinging to these hurt feelings. One of the Tibetan lamas talks about the mind, how the habitual patterns of the mind is like a dog chasing a stick. And we keep throwing this stick. And we don't realize that we can just stop throwing the stick. The dog won't keep running after it if nobody throws the stick. And here we are, throwing the stick and throwing the stick. I tried to figure out how long it would take one time for these dogs to stop going after the stick, and after 50 minutes I gave up. But even old dogs, they can learn new tricks. I had an old dog who, when I threw the ball, if it went into the street, she knew that she had to stop and wait for me to get the ball. So as she got older, after about 10 minutes, she'd just let the ball go in the street. Let him go get it. Well, maybe we can get tired of throwing the stick or this ball and realize that we don't have to do this. This is part of becoming a spiritual adult. But looking at and being familiar with ourselves requires that we become our own best friend. We have to be aware of our mental habits. We have to be aware of the emotional attachments that we have. We have to see when we're getting impatient and notice that and say, slow down. We got to see where we're greedy and taking too much food or doing too much or just not stopping and relaxing for a minute. And we have to see where anger and fear are governing our actions and our minds. And until we're recognizing, we're willing to recognize what it is that we're doing, we can't see that. And that's that living with the endarkenment. But we have to be honest with ourselves and see what it is. Let me just read this really beautiful description of what from the Diamond Sutra and the commentary, what he calls fine dust, because this fine dust is what keeps us from seeing clearly. Buddhists commonly point to the impermanence and insubstantiality of the world by characterizing it as being composed solely of fine dust. The Avatamsaka Sutra says, all sentient beings are the product of innumerable causes and conditions. Could there possibly be another world for any one of them? Enlightened beings reside here just as deluded beings reside here. Enlightened beings have pure minds and therefore perceive a pure world. Deluded beings have deluded minds, and therefore perceive a world made up of fine dust. Fine dust is just another way of saying delusion, because the dust accumulates, it obscures the original purity of things. Sometimes Buddhists call this dust guest dust, because it is not an inherent part of the Buddha mind. Just as it takes only a moment to wipe the dust from the surface of a mirror, so it only takes a moment to become enlightened. It's just that simple. Cleaning your view of things. But you have to recognize what it is that you're doing. The moment all defiled intentions are cleared from our consciousness, we will see ourselves in the mirror of perfect truth. Dust clouds the clarity of the metaphorical pool of enlightened awareness. Just as material things are made up of dust, so too are our perceptions and thoughts mere dust. Dust clouds the mind on all levels. Matter is dust, illusion is dust. The thoughts and perceptions are also dust. Only the Tathagata, the Buddha, sees the vast realm of emptiness in which all this floats in the clarity of perfect awareness. There's a lovely phrase by a Tibetan teacher that says, our mind should be as vast as a limitless universe. Within pure awareness, the mind cannot be disturbed by any thought. In this section of the Diamond Sutra, the metaphor of fine dust is used to reveal three levels of truth. One, the false level of ordinary reality that is nothing but dust. Two, the level of emptiness in which the dust has no fundamental reality. And three, the level of ultimate truth that merges the transcends these two levels. All Buddhas dwell in this third level. Simultaneously, both ordinary and ultimate awareness. At this level, there is nothing in the ordinary world of dust that they do not understand, and nothing in the realm of emptiness that can disturb their perfected intentions. One of the reasons that we look at things darkly is that we're trying to hold on to an idea of a self that has a permanent reality. And we don't realize that that self and everything in this world is constantly changing. And if you understand impermanence, you will understand emptiness. All phenomena are interconnected and dependent on other phenomena. Hence, nothing can remain the same. The Buddha taught that all things within the phenomenal world are constantly changing. Nothing is permanent. Impermanence is one way to understand emptiness. If all things are impermanent, then none of them can have an unchanging self-nature, and thus all of them are empty. This is not a negative void. This means that there is nothing substantial or permanent, or there's something that you can hold on to and say, this is real about ourselves. The Buddha taught that each and every phenomenon, every dharma, that's dharma with a small d, which means phenomenon, arises, abides, and changes, and is extinguished. Nothing stays the same. From moment to moment, everything is changing. This is human nature, to try to cling to a sense of permanence, but it is futile to do so. The Buddha often spoke about the suffering that arises from this very human tendency. In the Diamond Sutra, he teaches how to stop clinging to it, the impermanent signs of self, without becoming indifferent or careless. That's really important. Because if you let go of the substantiality of self, it's easy to fall into either indifference or carelessness. There are many ways of understanding impermanence. Two of the most basic are, one, momentary impermanence. All phenomena change from moment to moment. And two, serial impermanence. So though something has appeared to stay the same over a long period of time, In fact, they do not. Human life is an example of serial impermanence. And though we seem to remain the same person for our whole lives, in fact, we are always changing. In the Treatise on the Perfection of Great Wisdom, it says, "How are we to understand the impermanence of conditioned dharmas? All conditioned dharmas arise dependent upon other dharmas, and thus each of them is impermanent. Yesterday it did not exist, but today it does exist. Today it exists, but tomorrow it won't." Taking off these dark glasses of self is what we're trying to learn in our practice here. And one of the ways of doing that is to recognize impermanence, recognize that there is no self here that I can hold on to. The Buddha described his enlightenment as saying, "I was, am, and will be enlightened simultaneously with the universe." He was able to see things as they truly are. And that pure awareness is simply the ability to see through the veil of self. All of us have this ability. There's a lovely line in Sharanagama scripture that says, "That which understands the error is not itself in error." That part of us that sees, "Oops, I've just made a mistake here," that is the Buddha mind, that is pure awareness. That is what allows us to see what it is that we're doing, what it is that we're thinking, what it is that we're feeling, and not be attached to it. Because we're looking at it, where Master Daishin Morgan just wrote an article where he talks about zooming out, stepping back from that in-your-face anger, frustration, fear, whatever, and recognize, oh, that's an angry thought. Well, that's a petty, trivial thought. That's a greedy thought. Recognizing it from that place of awareness and letting it go. I saw a River Master one day. She got this letter. Somebody was railing and complaining about something they thought she had done or not done. And she had a grouch about it, and then she said, "End of grouch." And she was able to just drop it, just let it go. And that's, all of us have this ability to see that the things we're grouching about, the things we're upset about, the things that we're afraid of, are things that we can just drop. Because we're aware of the fact that this is fear, this is anger, this is frustration, this is greed. We're able to see it for what it is. It's just an angry thought. Do I have to join it? Do I have to put energy into it? Do I have to throw the ball for the dog again? When is that dog going to stop? That dog is not going to stop as long as that ball gets thrown. And as long as we cling to that hurt feeling, as long as we cling to that desire, as long as we cling to that inadequacy, we'll just be throwing that stuff out. But the minute we step back, the minute we look at ourselves, this is what mindfulness is about. It's to take a look at your unconsidered actions and accept responsibility. Yes, I said that. Yes, I did that. Yes, I forgot that. Yes, I sat there this morning looking at the altar saying, what have I forgotten? And Reverend Bhakti walks up and says, "Is anybody going to light the candles?" Ooh. It's just noticing both what you haven't done, what you are doing, what's good to do, what's not good to do. But again, not with judgment. Because the minute you put judgment in there, there's no more room to learn. And it also requires this acknowledgement. This is what Sangha is about, just acknowledging all of our past mistakes and offering them up, not holding on to them, not judging, not being afraid to admit them, But just saying, yes, I did this. Yes, I had that thought. Yes, I did this action. Yes, I got mad at somebody or grumbled or grouched or whatever. And so much of it is just recognizing that I've got something to learn. On that trip to England, I had a rather long journey. I got up Saturday morning and I was traveling with my daughter, who was 14 at the time, and spending the day with Reverend Master, who was in the midst of that Kensho experience in 76. And then I got on the, we got on the plane at 10 o'clock at night, and got off the plane 4 o'clock in the afternoon in Paris, and then we had to get on this bus, and the first bus drove away before we could get on. We had to figure out that you had to charge on the bus in front of everybody else, because if you didn't, the door would close and it would be off. We got on the bus, the next bus, then we had to get on a train, and then we had to get on a boat, and then we had to get on another train. And I arrive in London, 8 o'clock on Monday morning, in the midst of rush hour traffic, and it's like I couldn't believe how many people were coming out of the ground, coming off of buses, out of cars, off the street. It was just like the man from the country being kind of overwhelmed by, whoa, and 2 days without sleep. And all. And then the person who was supposed to pick me up wasn't there. So I figured, well, I got to go call them. Well, I went down this whole bank of phones and none of them would take my money. So I went down into the subway and I saw a bank of phones and I saw a lady on the telephone. I thought, I know that phone works. All the rest of those phones were broken, but that one works. I saw her talking. I know it works. So I get on that phone after she's finished, and I put my money in, and it still won't work. And it finally dawns on me that maybe it's not the phone that's broken. Maybe it's something I have to learn. And how much of our lives is spent trying to fix this thing outside? Rather than seeing what it is that I have to learn. We're constantly trying to fix the universe. There was a lady, I got off the bus the other day, and this lady walks up and says, are you with the Dalai Lama's gang? And I said, well, I'm a Buddhist monk, but I'm not a Tibetan monk. And she said, tell the Dalai Lama he should be speaking out to stop these wars. And I said, well, it isn't up to him to change the world. We have to all do what we need to do for ourselves. You know, we can't put the responsibility on the Dalai Lama to create peace in the world. In fact, we saw this movie about that called Dalai Lama Renaissance, where a whole group of Western intellectuals went to Dharamsala and they wanted the Dalai Lama to fix the problems of the world, and he finally got them to take a look at themselves and seeing what they could do about themselves. But it took them about 2 weeks to do this because they were all fixated on the fact that he was going to fix the world for them. And this is this focus of looking at everything through this idea of a self. We want a savior, we want a God, we want somebody to fix the universe to make it right. Because we're seeing all this darkness, we're seeing suffering, we're seeing wars, we're seeing murders, rapes, assaults, all sorts of economic disasters. And we haven't learned to accept the truth on its terms. We want the world to be different, fundamentally different. Bodhidharma's teaching is acceptance of suffering, sitting unmoved. The seeking of nothing, enlightenment proved. And the acceptance of suffering has to do with welcoming life's difficulties. There's a lovely book called Who Ordered This Truckload of Dung? It's 108 stories on how to welcome life's difficulties. It's a lovely book. I highly recommend it. But the book isn't going to do it for us. We have to look at the pile of dung that we've inherited and turn it into compost. Because until we can take that, it just becomes a public nuisance. And we've got our nose in the dung and we're complaining that it smells horrible and we don't realize that it has a good use. Ajahn Sumedho had a lovely line in this book I was reading on the Sound of Silence. He said, the Buddha's first teaching is that suffering is a fundamental fact of existence. And this is a noble truth. It's not a dismal reality. And we can be ennobled by the truth. We can be ennobled by suffering if we're willing to learn from it. Because it does have a purpose. And the purpose of suffering is to teach us that we in the past have acted out of endarkenment. We've acted out of delusion. We've acted with this fine dust over our vision. And it's created a mess. And it's our job to clean it up. And one of the ways to clean it up is to simply to be aware of what it is we're doing in this present moment. All of the past and the future are right here in the present moment. The Buddha defined the Buddha nature by saying it's unborn, it's undying, it's uncreated, it has no limits. It encompasses all of time and space. It's nothing you can get your head around. You can't hold on to it. You can't imagine it as a something. You can imagine it as what it's not. But what is the unborn? It's not a thing. It's not a thing. If you sit in meditation, you actually hear silence. It doesn't, there is an actual sound. But it doesn't have definition. It doesn't have borders. It doesn't have a beginning. It doesn't have an end. It's always there. You can tune into it if you want. You can ignore it if you want. You can be bothered by it if you want. But the reality is that there is this unborn, undying. Without that, we could not make good use of the suffering. We would just fall into despair because there's no way of using that. But filtering the suffering through our awareness, seeing the purity in it, seeing that there's something for me to learn here, that I can ask somebody how to use the telephone. And although the lady told me she was embarrassed on my behalf because it was culturally unacceptable in England to show your ignorance. And so I let her be embarrassed on my behalf, and I felt, this is my first lesson in cultural awareness that not everybody thinks like me, and that I can bungle into something and ask for how does it work, because it doesn't bother me at all. I assume that I don't necessarily know everything. But that's one of the cultural things that we've been conditioned to think, that if I don't know something, I'm going to look foolish. And so I don't want to appear to be ignorant. When in fact, by admitting our ignorance, we're opening our hearts to learning. And that's a really essential part of what we're doing in Buddhist practice. We're accepting the fact that there's a great deal I don't know. And even if I knew all the facts and figures in the world, there would be still a great deal I don't know. Because it isn't a knowing on that level that allows wisdom and compassion to come forth. They come forth out of the recognition of emptiness. That there is no permanent self here. There's nothing to defend. There's nobody that gets hurt. There is no me here that I've been spending all this time thinking about. And it's that me that clouds my vision of that purity, that initial pure awareness. And all I have to do is become aware of the fact of my ignorance without judgment, without rancor, without disappointment, and just recognize, thanks for telling me how the phone works. You have to dial the number, wait for the person to answer, and then put your money in. Well, bits of information like that can be very helpful. The ability to see the Buddha nature in ourselves is also the ability to see the Buddha nature in all things. Because what we're seeing, if you can see the Buddha nature in anything, you're seeing the Buddha nature from the Buddha nature. It's one calls and one replies. If you can see the Buddha in somebody else, you're seeing it within yourself. If you can find it within yourself, you'll be seeing it within everybody. Because it has no borders, it has no limits, it is not separate. All of the things that where we create dualities, the good and the bad, the right, the wrong, the like, the dislike, all of that stuff is this illusion of dust, this illusion of darkness, the illusion that suffering shouldn't be there because it's uncomfortable. And we have a society that says you should never be uncomfortable. You should have your room exactly the way you want it all the time. Never too hot, never too cold. Your car doesn't ever break down. It never not stops. It never has a flat tire. Never, you know. All this is our cultural illusion that somehow the world is supposed to just be perfect all the time. And what we have to do is recognize that when we're not paying attention and the gravy burns, it's because we're not paying attention, and the gravy burned to show us that we weren't paying attention. It's not a big deal. You have to just figure out what to do next. And that's not such a bad thing. How to make use of whatever this mess is that we've just created. And maybe the dog loves burnt gravy. Whatever. But being able to look at our mistakes from that place of awareness is this little fine-tuning shift. You know how when you get on a radio station and you get all this static and all of a sudden you just a little bit of fine-tuning and all of a sudden you get this really clear message. And that's really what this training is all about. It's doing these fine-tuning little adjustments to recognize our ignorance, to recognize there's something I don't know, to recognize that this thought of anger or frustration or whatever is just a thought. It's not even mine if I don't choose to join it. I can sit there and be aware of that, and that's all that's needed. Because I don't want anything from that thought. I don't want to be a perfect person that doesn't have this thought of meanness or anger or frustration or impatience. I can be an imperfect person that has these thoughts and I can be aware of that and I'm not bothered by that. But accepting our imperfection, accepting our humanness, accepting the fact that we do get angry when the car doesn't start, or we do get angry when the horse steps on our shoe, or we do get frustrated when something doesn't work and I don't know how to make the phone go. All of these things are there to help us if we make this little fine-tuning adjustment. And the meditation is that place of stillness where you've got the car in reverse and you got to come to the stillness first in order to put it into first gear. And a friend when I was in college, his mother had this very fancy Mercedes who had a synchronized gear shift in it. It was synchronized so that you could put it into reverse while going 60 miles an hour. And by accident, she did it. Well, meditation here is the thing that keeps us from destroying this transmission. It allows us to come back to this place of stillness where we can filter our ignorance through pure awareness instead of through our likes and our dislikes and instead of our habits of throwing the stick. We can come back to that place But we have to make that a practice, and we have to do that all the time. Not just when you're sitting on a cushion, but when you're making a meal, or when you're driving the car, or when you're going to the doctor's office, or when you're shopping, or whatever it is that you're doing. All of these are opportunities for you to learn how to accept reality on its terms. You know, you get to the doctor's office and somebody else has had an emergency and the doctor's not there and you've got to sit there for an hour and wait. Well, do you meditate with that or do you get upset and stomp out? What do you do when you're stuck in a traffic jam and you're late for your appointment? Do you work yourself up into a frenzy or do you just get on the cell phone and call the person and say, I'm going to be a few minutes late? Cell phones do have a good nature too, you know. Although I rarely find it. I actually have to work them. I'm sitting there stuck saying, how do I make the phone call? Still back in 1976. I'm technologically impaired. Awareness. Simply acknowledging what's going on, but not from the point of view of self. Just step back. And there's a great deal of difference in your own mind between the thoughts and emotions and this awareness. Because this awareness is not disturbed by things. This awareness simply is there. You can tune into it. You can go to that place of awareness. It's not conditioned. All of our thoughts, all of our emotions, these are all conditioned things. These are all impermanent. This awareness has no conditions. It is pure awareness. It is that instant enlightenment that allows you to go to that place that is undisturbed, even though you just had your feelings hurt. Just a shift, fine-tuning adjustment here. For those who are just coming for the first week for their introductory thing, let me just go over the Four Noble Truths for you, basically, that the first is the noble truth of suffering, that suffering exists and it's a fundamental fact of existence, and that the cause of suffering is the clinging to self, it's the attachment to desire. It's not the fact that we have the desire, it's that we won't let go of it. It's that clinging. If you cling to anything, no matter how good it is, the clinging causes the suffering. And that there is a cure. That's the third noble truth. And that cure resides in the walking of this Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path has basically three sections. One is understanding, or wisdom. The other is action, and the other is meditation. So right understanding and right thought are the first two steps of the Eightfold Path. And out of that understanding, right understanding, then we can purify our intentions. That's what right thought is about. So if we can see the Buddha nature in things, if we can welcome those difficulties, if we can take that suffering and learn from it, then we have right understanding. And then we can then tune into that purity of intention from which we look at things. And right action has to do with right speech, the keeping of the precepts, and the right and right livelihood. And right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration is how meditation is practiced. And the effort is both the effort of training as if our hair were on fire, this eagerness to do whatever is needed to be done, and patience. And they're not opposites. It's both and. And the paramitas are the way of practicing to realize enlightenment and to get rid of endarkenment. And those paramitas are generosity, self-restraint, patience, meditation, and developing discerning wisdom. I'm going to read another couple of quotes from this book, although these don't follow chronologically, so I'm going to read them from my notes. This is on generosity. The wonder of behaving without attachment. First few sentences are from the Diamond Sutra. Moreover, Subhuti, this is the Buddha talking, within this phenomenal world, a bodhisattva ought to practice generosity without basing it on anything. This means that he should not base his generosity on form, he should not base his generosity on sound, smell, taste, touch, or thought. Subhuti, the generosity of a bodhisattva should be like this and should not be based on any delusion of self whatsoever. And why is this? If the generosity of a bodhisattva is not based on any delusion of self whatsoever, then his goodness will be immeasurable. And now this is the commentary by Venerable Master Sun Yun. You probably pronounce that properly. The six paramitas are the basic virtues of a bodhisattva. They are also a sort of summation of all the teachings of the Buddha, since they are the perfect unification of thought and behavior. The six paramitas are generosity, restraint, patience, diligence, concentration, and wisdom. The six paramitas are the highest form of human behavior. In the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha uses generosity to represent all of the paramitas. There are several kinds of generosity recognized in Buddhism. The first and most obvious is material generosity. When we give something of value to someone, we are engaging in material generosity. The second is helping people let go of fear. The Buddha taught that fearlessness can be a gift, patience, or moral propriety. It's a really important teaching. Because when we act out of compassion and wisdom, we are acting from a place of wisdom and of emptiness, knowledge of the emptiness of things. And when we act from that place, that's when we step off onto the unknown. That's when we're willing to do whatever needs to be done. Whether we like it or dislike it, whether it's good or bad, it needs to be done. There's the mess, clean it up. That's fearlessness. We give this gift whenever we behave with compassion, kindness, patience, or moral propriety. The third form of generosity is most important. Get the right page. This is the gift of the Dharma. Whenever we teach the Dharma, disseminate Dharma literature, or discuss the Dharma with others, we are giving the highest of all gifts because only the Dharma has the power to help others understand the truth. Material gifts may bring comfort to others. The gift of fearlessness frees their spirit. The gift of the Dharma shows them how to overcome all suffering. True generosity inwardly teaches us to overcome egotism as we outwardly help others. When we are truly generous without expecting anything in return, we achieve a profound state of wisdom. The consciousness of someone who is generous without attachment is triumphant. It has achieved, however briefly, perfect moral and philosophical liberation. The awareness of someone who is generous without basing his generosity on any phenomenal perception whatsoever is liberated awareness. Passing thought. That state of awareness, however briefly it lasts, is enlightenment. It is a direct glimpse into the mind of a Buddha. In an act of perfect generosity, there is no awareness of a giver, a gift, or a recipient of the gift. There is nothing but the undefiled goodness of the enlightened mind. Surely, All of us have glimpsed this state.